Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a bipartisan revolt in the House of Representatives against President Obama's Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement following the leak of a draft text of a chapter on intellectual property rights published by WikiLeaks. Lori Wallach, the founder and director of Global Trade Watch, a division of Public Citizen, joins us to discuss Tea Party and progressive opposition to the president's fast-track authority, which could torpedo the deal. Then we'll examine the endemic political corruption in the Philippines that is hampering relief efforts, while the very politicians from the ruling families who have looted the country for decades are appearing on TV defending aid response. Michael Bula, a professor of political science at Northern Illinois University, who does political risk evaluations in the Philippines, joins us to discuss what is likely to happen to the aid that is pouring in from international donors, assuming it reaches those in need because of damage to the already neglected infrastructure. Then finally, we will speak with the anti-corporatist activist, the Reverend Billy, who is facing a battery of charges and jail time for a 15-minute musical protest he and his gospel choir staged at a mock religious revival at a Chase Bank in New York City last month. They were wearing toad hats to commemorate the golden toad forced into extinction by climate change and the $2.17 billion with which Chase has financed coal companies involved in mountaintop removal. And joining us now is Lori Wallach, the founder and director of Global Trade Watch, a division of the nonprofit watchdog group Public Citizen. She is an expert on the operations and outcomes of trade policies such as NAFTA, WTO, CAFTA, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. She works closely with Congress, scholars, and activists in the U.S. and developing countries to foster the growing debate about the implications of different models of globalization on jobs, offshoring, wages, the environment, public health, and food safety, equality, and social justice, and democratically accountable governance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lori Wallach.
Thank you.
And, Lori, this leak from WikiLeaks of a chapter of a draft on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, of course, comes just a week before the international negotiators are to meet in Salt Lake City. And it also comes on the same day that a group of Democrats sent a letter to the president, and now a group of Republicans have sent a letter to the president. And you've been on the Hill today. I understand people are pretty riled up. Is that true?
It is true. Mainly because this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which actually was started under Bush in 2008, has been under negotiation in incredible secrecy. There are 600 U.S. official corporate advisors, but until this summer, Congress, which has the constitutional authority over trade, was not able to see the text, and it's still not available for the public or the press. There are 29 chapters, but only five of them actually have to do with trade. The other 24, like this intellectual property chapter that leaked today, would set policies that we think of as being decided by us in Congress and city councils that we'd have to conform all of our domestic laws to. And basically, a lot of it is backdoor legislating of things that could not get through Congress or the other countries' parliaments. So today's chapter, patent extensions that would raise medicine prices, limits on internet freedom, including chunks of SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, that literally was tanked in Congress just last year.
So what is motivating this unusual coalition of hardline Tea Partiers and progressives? Is it because of the Congress is being cut out of the loop? Is it just sort of a turf battle, or are they genuinely outraged?
I think there are three things that have come together as the perfect storm. One thing certainly is the way that the administration has handled Congress, has cut Congress out of this process, which delves so deeply into their business. So the chapters would set things on, for instance, government procurement, whether we can have labor conditions or environmental conditions or Buy American policy would even be banned. It has rules about immigration visas, about food safety policies. We'd have to import meat that doesn't meet our standards. And it has a set of rules that would give foreign companies better treatment in the United States and submit the U.S. to foreign tribunals where foreign companies could collect U.S. taxpayer dollars for having to meet our laws. So all this content in Congress has been cut out in a way that hasn't been the case, as secretive as past agreements have been for past agreements. I mean, Bush put on government websites the draft of the last big agreement like this, the Free Trade Area of the Americas. The second thing that's going on is not so much, I would say, a turf battle as a perennial structural fight. So trade in the U.S. has a very sort of interesting history. Congress has exclusive constitutional authority over trade. And I call that an effect of the Tea Party hangover, and I'm talking about the Boston Tea Party. Because in that instance, the king, literally, put up unilateral tariffs on tea and other stuff. And when the founders, after the Revolution, wrote the Constitution, they put control of trade in the more diffuse body, the Congress. So this big fight today, the letters were about a Nixon-era, really power-grab procedure. It's rarely used, called fast track. And it delegates away Congress's authority over trade, but it also delegates away really a lot of legislating authority. It allows the executive branch to sort of diplomatically legislate on all that stuff that I was talking about that's Congress's, but doing it through the negotiations. And then the third thing is the contents of the actual agreement. So of those 24 non-trade chapters, there are things that really have angered Democrats and Republicans alike. And those include some of these issues about internet freedom. As you'll recall, some of the libertarian groups, the most conservative members of Congress, were against SOPA, as were progressives. Another thing that's in there that makes the left and the right crazy is those international tribunals, the notion the U.S. government could get sued by foreign corporations and foreign tribunals and have our treasury raided. So those three things have been brewing, and I think it came to a head now because the administration is rushing into trying to finish the TPP, trying to get Congress to give away its authority with fast track. And it was sort of that BASTA moment where on both sides of the aisle, Congress said, not so fast.
Again, I'm speaking with Lori Wallach, the founder and director of Global Trade Watch, a division of the nonprofit watchdog group Public Citizen. She's an expert on the operations and outcomes of trade policy such as NAFTA, WTO, CAFTA, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Details of which, a chapter of which on intellectual property was leaked by WikiLeaks. We spoke some time back when there was the first leak, and I guess what's different with this leak is that the other partners in this partnership are the ones that their input has been revealed, and this includes New Zealand, Singapore, Canada, Chile, and Malaysia, Australia. What else?
Brunei, Mexico, Vietnam,
Chile. Yeah, and that's about it. But what I find conspicuously absent there, of course, is China, and that's my understanding of what this pact in many ways is about. Isn't this about the pivot to Asia, which is a cover, if you will, for containing China?
Well, I think probably from the State Department's perspective, the idea would be to, well, actually, former Secretary of State Clinton said this, would be to project U.S. power through this international commercial instrument into China's backyard. Now, interestingly for the other countries, New Zealand, Australia, etc., they have much closer relationships with China. And for them, the governments have said, if this is anti-China, we can't be part of it. So that's sort of playing on two levels. Also, the previous U.S. trade ambassador, the top trade guy, the U.S. trade representative last year, said nothing would make him happier than if China joined the TPP, which is kind of perverse if this is supposed to be ring-fencing China. That said, I also think that part of what TPP is really about is a corporate push that we've seen pop up different ways to implement internationally and lock in rules that favor them that are hard to get through normal democratic processes. It's sort of like that shell game at the carnival. The negotiations happen under different names. So folks will remember there was a big push that started in 2001 to expand the World Trade Organization's scope and power. Actually, it started in 99. That was what the big Seattle protests were against. Well, in that context, a lot of big developing countries said, no, we're actually not going to expand drug patents and increase prices. No, we're not going to roll back financial regulation. And so that got stuck. In the meantime, at a different point, there was an attempt to do this kind of agreement with a bunch of Latin American countries. And Brazil and Argentina and Jamaica and other countries ultimately put the kibosh on that. This is sort of the latest version. And it gets talked about as writing the rules for the 21st century. But whose rules? Those 600 corporate trade advisors. I mean, literally, the agreement is packed with stuff that has explicitly been rejected in the democratic policymaking procedures of lots of the countries. So the companies get together, they talk to these negotiators, the discussions are behind closed doors, and once an agreement is signed, it gets voted yes or no, and then once it's in place, no changes can be made unless every country agrees. So it's like cementing, super gluing into place these very retrograde policies.
Well, but I believe that you think this is could be the end of the TPP. I mean, in many ways, we have a president who's under siege with these two signature achievements, one of which is healthcare reform, which is floundering because of the launch via a faulty website of so-called Obamacare. And this TPP, which I think he's also heavily invested in, how much do you think? Obviously, this is just the beginning of the growing outrage right today with these leaks. But this is not likely to go away. It's likely to escalate, isn't it?
It is, and it's been boiling in a lot of countries. The thing that you have to take into consideration with these so-called trade agreements, these corporate rule agreements, is unlike, say, healthcare, where companies are against parts of it, on this, all the corporate interests are united, from big pharma to the oil and gas companies to big content to the chronic job offshoring, used to be U.S. manufacturers, now they make it someplace else and sell it here. All of these different Wall Street, they're actually all united. And that makes these agreements have a tendency to be like zombies. Every time you think that they are boxed and buried, that coalition of corporate power ends up trying to revive them. So will the TPP be done anytime soon? Definitely not. Will it definitely get done? Oh, I wouldn't say necessarily. But is it down and out? Not yet. And the way, actually, that these agreements ultimately get derailed is when people start looking at the details and making a fuss. So, you know, for folks, the agreement is so broad, different parts of it are going to make you irritated, are going to make you scared, are going to make you worry about your future. And one place you can get the overview of the whole thing is a website called ExposeTheTPP.org, www.exposeTheTPP.org. You can literally pull up a fact sheet. What does it mean on GMO labeling? What does it mean for medicine prices? What does it mean for jobs and wages? Service sector jobs, manufacturing, climate and energy, all of those issues get implicated. And then if you want to really dig into the details, or for instance, look at a lot of analysis about today's leak, you can go to our website, tradewatch.org, and dig in deep. There's a whole fast-track section that explains about that procedure and what you can do to make sure your members of Congress don't give away their authority. And in California, interestingly, where I know you're based, there is a bipartisan majority of your House delegation who got on these letters, Republicans and Democrats alike, which is hopeful. Mm-hmm. But that also is a continuing fight.
Well, Laurie, I'm afraid we've run out of time, and I must say that just as a journalist, I'm extremely concerned about narrowing international standards for fair use, which allows journalists to use copyrighted information without paying royalties. That could kill journalism. So let's stay in touch, and I appreciate your information that you've given us here today.
Thank you very much. I've spent a lot of quality time with that leaked text today, and so maybe another time we can talk about the details, because there's all kinds of outrageous stuff. Folks, you could get knocked off of your internet provider and have mandatory fines for right. small-scale, non-commercial copying, like sending your mother a recipe. Not good.
Not good. Thank you so much, Laurie. Again, Laurie is the founder and director of Global Trade Watcher Division of the nonprofit watchdog group Public Citizen. She's an expert on the operations and outcomes of trade policy such as NAFTA, WTO, CAFTA, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. She works closely with Congress, scholars, and activists in the U.S. in developing countries to foster the growing debate about implications of different models of globalization on jobs, offshoring, wages, the environment, public health and food safety, equality and social justice, and democratically accountable governance. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the endemic corruption in the Philippines.
Isilang ka sa mundong ito, laking tuwa ng magulang mo, at ang kamay nilang iyong ilaw. At ang nanay at tatay mo'y di malaman ang gagawin.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Buehler, who's a professor of political science at Northern Illinois University and a research fellow at the Asia Society. He has contributed to political risk evaluation for private sector companies operating across Southeast Asia and is a regular contributor to news briefs on political and economic developments in the region for Oxford Analytica, a business consultancy company. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Buehler.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Well, fine. Thanks, Michael. And you have studied the economies and the politics of a number of Southeast Asian countries, including the Philippines. And I spoke yesterday with a research analyst there with a nonprofit NGO, and she painted a pretty dark picture of political corruption and political neglect that has led to a infrastructure crisis that is now becoming apparent because of this storm, that all of the aid that is being promised around the world is going to have a difficult time getting to the people who need it. So in spite of what the president of the Philippines is saying, that things are under control, I got the impression that things weren't really under control.
Yeah, I would definitely share that sentiment. Also, the person you had on your program yesterday, I completely share her views that this is basically now, what we see right now is the result of decades of corruption and endemic rent seeking in the Philippines by the very elites that now are on TV lamenting the situation in the Philippines. In many ways, a lot of these politicians, including the Philippine president, are very hypocritical in how they basically assess the situation on the ground, and very cynical in many ways as well.
So explain further how endemic it is, because corruption and hypocrisy in Philippine politics, because Aquino, of course, is the son of the former president and the slain leader who returned to the Philippines and barely got off the jet before he was killed by Marcos. And he's fashioned himself as a reformer, and he's boasted about the 7.8% growth rate of the Philippines greater than China. So give us a sense then of where he fits into the lexicon, because he's blaming most of the corruption on his predecessor, Arroyo.
You know, I mean, the current president of the Philippines is really just emblematic of the situation of Philippine politics. I mean, Benigno Noñoy Aquino is, as you correctly pointed out, his mother was the president of the Philippines a few years ago, and his father was a contender to be the president of the Philippines. And that just basically shows how Filipino politics are defined and shaped by a small number of families, or you may call them oligarchs or local bosses, that really have entrenched themselves in local Filipino politics and have ruled the country for a very long time. I mean, some of the provinces in the Philippines have been ruled by the same family for 70-plus years, seven decades, same family, mother, son, father. And that just is just an indication for how endemic corruption and rent-seeking really is in the country.
So how different then? I mean, I was going to be a little cynical and suggest that we have our Clintons and Bushes here. What's the difference?
Sure. I mean, you know, if I talk about these issues to people in Southeast Asia, they very often say that we in the West shouldn't be judgmental about this. And they do make that comparison. And they say in the United States, you have the Kennedys and the Bush family and the Clinton family that have become very influential in politics. I think the difference really is that it's just more prevalent in the Philippines. That you have, as I said, probably the two dozen, three dozen of these families at the local level. And I think in the U.S., in many ways, at the local level, it's still a bit more competitive, at least. But no one says the U.S. doesn't have a corruption problem. And in many ways, quite ironically, the situation the Philippines are in right now with these local clans defining and shaping local politics, that is a result of the American colonial period in the Philippines. So, of course, yeah, you can say that there are parallels, because a lot of these politics we see in the Philippines have their roots in the American colonial period.
So give me a sense then of, you talked about the hypocrisy of these politicians now appearing on television, including the President Aquino, and defending the lackluster aid effort. And you said that they're being extremely cynical. Does that extend to the possibility that much of this aid will disappear?
Sure. I mean, this is something your guest yesterday didn't probably want to mention, right? But I saw that firsthand when a similar disaster struck in Indonesia a couple of years ago. And the police personnel, the military, were amongst the first that would actually steal developmental aid from the poorest of the poor. So as I was driving into disaster zones, the military was driving out with trucks full of goods they had just taken away from the most needy. And I have no doubt that we see similar kind of issues in the Philippines. But the bigger problem probably is that as probably the government tries to rebuild some of these towns and villages that have been completely destroyed using foreign developmental aid, I guarantee you that there is going to be a lot of embezzlement, a lot of corruption in the reconstruction process, because that is one of the hallmarks of, you know, Philippine politics, that you use construction projects to enrich yourself if you're a politician. So I think the really sad story is going to unfold in a couple of months from now.
So is that what's going on with these scandals that the guest yesterday, Rosario Guzman, referred to? Apparently they are foreign companies that were hired to dredge the ports, I believe, in Manila. There was a contract of $430 billion to a Belgium company, and also a $276 million French port building project, and a Chinese financed rail line. And apparently, you know, as I say, Aquino, the current president, says he's reconsidering $2 billion in foreign funded infrastructure projects that were greenlighted by his predecessor, Gloria Arroyo. So that, is that how the corruption works? You give a foreign company a contract and they deposit money for you in a Swiss bank?
I mean, this is one of the many ways, right, that rent seeking works. I mean, you also have to think about predatory taxes, rules and regulations that are set up with the sole purpose to basically create obstacles so that people have to pay a bribe if they want to get around these obstacles. And so the embezzlement of developmental aid is just one of the many manifestations of corruption in the Philippines, but in this particular context, obviously a very important one, because there's going to be a lot of money that is going to flow into reconstruction. Yes.
So you mentioned Indonesia, and of course Indonesia was under a military dictatorship, the Suhartos, and the Philippines were under the Marcos dynasty, their dictatorship, which finally ended because of the brazen killing of Ninoy Aquino, literally as he stepped off the plane from exile in the United States. So what's the difference here? The Suhartos just stole everything, apparently, you know, had a wealth estimated way over $30 billion stashed away. I don't know what the wealth of the Marcoses is, but they also operate through a kind of feudal system where you have various provinces run by ruling families. So is there a kind of trickle-down network there? I mean, what's the difference between one military dictatorship in Indonesia, and how does the Filipino political structure compare to Indonesia?
I think the main difference is that in the Philippines, actually, the military dictator Marcos was brought down by the very oligarchs that have been in power before and have been in power ever since. So this romantic notion that we have in the West about how Marcos was brought down by a people power movement and people would take to the streets and get rid of an awful dictator, that is just half of the story, I would say, because a big, important force were these local oligarchs that actually didn't profit under the Marcos system, because he sidelined them, he bypassed a lot of them, and would distribute the money he embezzled to friends and followers within his circle. And so an important democracy, pro-democracy force, quite ironically, are these local oligarchs in the Philippines that exist precisely because elections have actually been restored. And so I think that is the main difference to Indonesia, that you have these local clans that really shape politics in the Philippines, and that is less developed in Indonesia.
Well, of course, there was a case down in one of the southern islands of a very murderous clan that run a province who just I think they murdered a group of soldiers, did they not?
Yeah, and a couple of years ago, they actually murdered around 53 journalists and women that were accompanying a candidate that tried to run in local elections. And so the Philippines, yes, has also a huge small arms problem. And again, the roots of that small arms problem lie in the American colonial period, where when the right to bear arms was put into the Filipino constitution.
Oh, so we have the NRA to thank for the chaos in the Philippines.
I mean, I would make that argument, yes, that the Philippines has a small arms problem because it has been an American colony.
So, Michael Buehler, we're talking at a point where there's a lot of calls from charitable organizations to donate money to the Philippines, and obviously by suggesting how endemic corruption is, we may be deterring people from giving money, which is not necessarily a helpful thing. How can concerned American citizens navigate around this problem of dire humanitarian need on the one hand, but the conduit through which much of it goes is, of course, a rotten political system?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I have no good answer for that. I've worked in anti-corruption for quite some time, and I've become more frustrated over the years with regard to developmental aid. And my best advice would be, if you want to help in some way, then try to do so through private channels. Maybe you know someone who is from the Philippines here in the U.S., and that person could directly give some money, donate some money to relatives in the Philippines. But I'm very critical about international aid organizations. I'm very critical about NGOs as well in the Philippines with regard to the capacity they have or the will they have to actually distribute some of these funds they are now getting.
Well, but the figure that we heard yesterday from Rosario Guzman in the Philippines was at least 4 million people are in dire need. It's pretty critical, isn't it, to get aid to those people right now. I believe the U.S. military is stepping into the breach, but that's a lot of people, right, in a devastated island with no infrastructure.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, it's devastating, and it's a very, very sad story. I just wish I could give you other news than it is very difficult also because of the situation in the Philippines, the political situation and the capacity of the government that is very low and the incompetence of many of the politicians we've seen on TV over the last couple of days. And I'm really a bit at loss in terms of what could be done at the moment.
Well, the other issue, of course, is how does the actual aid physically get to the people in Leyte province, in this devastated city, that when you have the Philippines has the lowest percentage of paved roads compared to Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam, Thailand, and Singapore. It has the worst score in other key indicators such as fixed phone lines, households, and power. Households with power and electricity lost in transmission. And now you've got what little infrastructure existed being devastated by this superstorm. So that seems to be adding salt to the wound, surely.
Sure. I mean, right now it's a logistics problem, right? How do you get, like, aid to the people that are most in need, and how do you now bring some order into this very chaotic situation? But I was more thinking about the medium and long term. Now, once reconstruction is underway, we for sure are going to see more appeals to donate money for reconstruction efforts in the Philippines. And as much as I think that this is a good thing, as I said, I'm very critical about how the Filipino government or local NGOs or international aid agencies are actually distributing and handling the donations they are getting. So I agree with you right now. I mean, it's just a logistics problem that maybe NGOs and aid agencies can't really do all that much. It really is about the military and the government to now provide immediate assistance to the people in the Philippines.
So obviously we have oligarchs in our country, and we have people like the Koch brothers buying our politics and convincing working Americans to vote against their own interests, which they do very skillfully. And that would seem to be also the problem in the Philippines, is it? Why do the Filipino people put up with this endemic corruption with a handful of ruling families, both at the provincial and national level, running their politics?
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting question, right? Why do people vote for corrupt politicians, and why do people re-elect corrupt politicians? Now, there's certainly a history of people doing this in the United States as well, but I think in the Philippines or all over Southeast Asia, I think it has a lot to do with inequality, that ordinary citizens have just no chance to run in even local politics as candidates because they are very expensive. I mean, if you want to run in local elections, you need hundreds of thousands of dollars to mount a serious bid for a mayor position, for example. But then there's also plenty of rules and regulations that keep ordinary people from running. I mean, you have education requirements, for example, that you need to have a bachelor's degree to run as a candidate, which disqualifies many people in the Philippines. And so in many ways, these oligarchs have really set up the institutional framework in their favor. And that may explain why you see like an entrenchment of these families.
And of course, they also have, these oligarchs have armed militias, right? So if you,
sure, I mean,
you step out of line,
violence as well. I mean, there's a lot of voter intimidation and a lot of election-related violence in the Philippines. Every election cycle, there's about 200 candidates, not ordinary people. There's plenty more that die, but there's about 200 candidates that are dying each time there is an election in the Philippines through other candidates.
Well, just in closing, Marco Bula, there is, of course, a considerable diaspora here in Los Angeles of Filipinos, and there are 10 million overseas workers that provide the Philippines with $24 billion in remittances, a lot of it from the Middle East, from Saudi Arabia and other countries like that. But at the same time, you've got a third of the population of the Philippines living in poverty on $2 a day. What would the role, or could the role be, of the Philippine diaspora in terms of this situation, both stepping up and also perhaps weighing in a little bit on the need for more transparency about what happens to all this money?
I mean, in many ways, the Filipino diaspora in the U.S. they have contributed a lot to what we see in the Philippines in terms of economic progress. And as you say, I mean, many of the people living in the Philippines, ordinary Filipinos, depend on the remittances from people living here in the United States. Now, as I mentioned before, if as an American you want to help in some way, maybe the diaspora here in the U.S. could fulfill and play a certain role in kind of facilitating donations that Americans want to give to the Philippines, and in that way somewhat bypass the rotten government system in the Philippines. So I think they could play an important role over the next couple of months in kind of channeling funds back to the Philippines.
Well, Michael Bueller, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Bueller, who's a professor of political science at the Northern Illinois University and a research fellow at the Asia Society. He has contributed to political risk evaluation for private sector companies operating across Southeast Asia and is a regular contributor to news briefs on political and economic developments in the region for Oxford Analytica, a business consultancy company. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with the anti-corporatist activist, the Reverend Billy.
There's been a crash on the levee, and Mama, you've been refused. Well, it's king for king and it's queen for queen. It's gonna be the meanest flood that anybody's ever seen. Oh, Mama, you're gonna miss your best friend now. You're gonna have to find yourself.
New York, you're perfect. Oh, please don't change a thing. Your mild billionaire mayor's now convinced he's a king. And so the boring collect, I mean all disrespect. New York, I love you, but you're bringing me down.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Reverend Billy, who is an anti-corporatist activist, who in the role of a revivalist minister leads the Stop Shopping Gospel Choir, a group of activists who defend neighborhood economies and freedom of expression in public places. They are known for their staging of mock religious revivals against consumerism, and their devils are Keystone, tar sands, mountaintop removal, fracking, and the banks that finance environmental plunder. He is currently facing a battery of misdemeanor charges and jail time, including rioting, and is facing jail time for a 15-minute musical protest he and his gospel choir staged at a Chase Bank in Midtown New York City last month. They were wearing toad hats at the time. Welcome to Background Briefing, Reverend Billy.
Thank you, Brother Ian. Good to be here.
And the Lord be with you in thy spirit.
No, leave the Lord out of it. No patriarchy use.
Okay, all right. No, well, the Lord S.
That idea of God resembles Jamie Dimon just a little bit too much.
And Jamie Dimon, of course, is Lucifer in your eyes. You went about a month ago to the Chase Bank in Midtown New York City, and you and your gospel choir were wearing toad hats to commemorate the golden toad, which was forced into extinction by climate change, and also the $2.17 billion with which Chase has financed coal companies involved in mountaintop removal. So is that, am I characterizing your protest correctly?
Well, that's a very good wrap-up. According to the research group in the Netherlands called banktrack.org, which is used by Rainforest Action Network and other people that we trust, Chase is the top financier of CO2 emissions going into the air in the world, you know, with the possible exception of the Communist Party of China, which is sort of hard to measure. Chase is the, you know, comes down to us after all the evolution and mergers and so forth from, it was the Standard Oil Bank. It was the Rockefeller Bank and still is. I mean, I think one of the secrets here that a lot of people don't understand is that the industries, the projects, the fossil fuel projects that create climate change, they're all cash-starved. The top 50 companies in the world of hydrofracturing are all in debt. They're expanding so fast, they need money. And these big banks, Chase leading the charge, are business partners to the climate disruptors. That's a secret. For some reason, people, the average American just doesn't know how implicated the big hedge funds and banks are.
Well, didn't these big... Well, I was going to ask you, though. Did Jamie Dimon get his feet wet when the recent tropical storm blasted New Jersey and New York? And my understanding is that the Battery Park in Wall Street was flooded. So did they notice that? Have they made the connection?
I think that Jamie was at a party in the Hamptons. I don't know where he was.
Well,
Goldman Sachs, I'm talking to you from Manhattan. I'm talking to you from my lawyer's office in an area of town called Soho. And this had water up to our waist here in some places. All the basements were full. But Goldman Sachs, just a little bit to the south of here, was glowing because it had independent generators. And we had this one building that was just, all the lights were on. Everything else was dark.
So, again, I'm speaking with the Reverend Billy, who's an anti-corporatist activist who, in the role of a revivalist minister, leads the Stop Shopping Gospel Choir, a group of activists who defend neighborhood economies and freedom of expression in public places. They are known for their staging of mock religious revivals against consumerism, and their devils are Keystone, tar stands, mountaintop removal, fracking, and the banks that finance environmental plunder. He is currently facing a battery of misdemeanor charges, including rioting, and is facing jail for a 15-minute musical protest he and his gospel choir staged at the Chase Bank in Midtown, New York City, last month. They were wearing toad hats at the time. And apparently these toad hats really disturbed some of the employees of the Chase Bank, even though apparently all of the faces were of the people wearing the toad hats were quite visible. They weren't in any way...
Yes, we pointed that out to the district attorney's office, that we were not wearing masks.
And you weren't carrying guns, right?
Golden toad costumes are... They're like big turbans. They're like giant hats with big, shiny black eyes, and they're golden-orange enamel, papier-mâché constructions made by puppeteers in the Stop Shopping choir. And they're very beautiful. They're very imposing. We think they're comic. You know, at the beginning of the action, we talked to the people there, and we said, this is a protest, and it's going to be over in a few minutes, and don't be upset. And then we handed them the information that we have about JPMorgan Chase's culpability, in which it puts billions of dollars into industries that create climate change. And our idea is to be entertaining, and humor and music is how we open up people so that we get past where we usually get with people when we're progressive with them, which they look at us and they oh my man, more protesters. So we come with a kind of entertainment, and we come with our information easily digested. We give them the information sheet, and it's in language you understand. We don't want to scare people. We want to bring them into a state of mind where they may feel open to hearing. And ultimately, I think that the workers inside Chase and Citi and B of A, the workers inside of HSBC and UBS and the Royal Bank of Scotland, these Deutsche Bank, these giant reservoirs of trillions of dollars that are just consistently going to tar sands, to the pipelines, the high-pressure fracking, to the methane-producing and CO-producing, nitrous oxide-producing projects that are they're making the physical systems of the Earth go off the rails. Am I mixing my metaphors?
Well,
such that, you know, we have Hurricane Haiyan, called Yolanda by the Filipinos, with the force of a tornado, but it's not a tornado, it's a hurricane, and it's miles, miles and miles wide. This all was predicted by the natural scientists who have been trying to talk to us for years, and we don't listen. The United Nations climate change report came out a few weekends ago, and Miley Cyrus's ass and John Boehner shutting down Washington and a bunch of these fools were able to dominate the media when we had thousands of natural scientists telling us we need to act now. We need to act radically and quickly. We just don't have the political will. We actually don't have the media telling us. I mean, there was a sum up in Mother Jones. I'm sure that you in your wonderful radio stations were summing things up, but generally that report, the fifth IPCC report, did not get out.
Well, and obviously you're trying to redress that incredible imbalance in the media in terms of attention and focus on and making the connections. We have thousands of weathermen and women, mostly women, with tight sweaters on, chirping about the weather, but they never make the connection to global warming and climate is actually not the same as weather. But in terms of you've been arrested probably, 75 times over the years? You stage this protest at the Chase Bank in Midtown, and then you're on the subway going home, and what happens then?
Well, I'm the televangelist. I'm dressed up like an Elvis impersonating late-night cable preacher. I'm the icon of right-wing apocalyptic Christian preaching, you know. All of those guys are climate skeptics. And I'm surrounded by extinct dancing toads. And We timed our performance to 15 minutes and took the escalator down to the street. And I tried to kind of tear down my costume, but it's a feature of it is high hair. And you know what they say, the higher the hair, the closer to God. Amen, hallelujah.
So
I don't think they covered up my basic shtick adequately, and they caught me on the platform. I answered the descriptions of the bankers. He looks like Jimmy Swaggart. You know, I still looked too much like Jimmy Swaggart. And
you didn't Nehemiah have any, didn't and have I any 15-year-old were girls with
a bag full of toad heads, and so we were taken to jail.
So you were taken to jail, and then why then did the district attorney throw the book at you, and you're facing jail time here for political protest?
Yes, a year in prison for a 15-minute performance. One of the charges is menacing. Another one of the charges is unlawful assembly. The number of people from our Stop Shopping choir was about, I think, 14 of us. Unlawful assembly in a park, you're not supposed to, and this needs to be defeated. It's such an obvious appropriation of our First Amendment rights. But right now, I think standing in the books, you're not supposed to have 21 people. You're not supposed to have more than 20 people in a park in New York. You know, this comes from Giuliani, basically, 9/11 paranoia. You're not supposed to have 21 people in which there seems to be, to an observing policeman, a, you know, common message. And that constitutes you have to have a permit, wait 6 weeks or 2 months for the permit to come through before you can do that. So the First Amendment isn't an adequate permit, apparently. So the police are starting their sirens out here in Spring Street with me talking that way. Amen. The NSA is everywhere. Oh, my God. So unlawful assembly is one of the charges. All I can think of is that the big banks are very tied to our governments. The big banks are very tied to our police forces. The Occupy movement, which spread to 2,600 locations, starting right over here at Zuccotti Park. The Homeland Security was consulting local police departments. J.P. Morgan Chase gave the New York Police Department $4.6 million at the beginning of the Zuccotti Park uprising. And I have to believe that something about our messaging telling the Chase Bank workers that and customers, wealthy customers there in Midtown, telling them that, in our opinion, Chase is a top-earth criminal. They are financing the disruption of the natural life around us such that something like Hurricane Sandy happens. And that is not a message that they want their own workers to get. So I don't know. We touched a nerve. It's a secret that needs to be opened up, that we need to discuss, that we need. I'm glad to be on the radio with you right now, Mr. Masters. We need to say climate change is being financed by people who are profiting from it. And they are standing here in front of us. And they're the same people that derailed the economy in 2008. They're the same people. And none of them are in jail. Amen?
Well, not only is Jamie Dimon not in jail, he's negotiating to pay the Justice Department $13 billion for malfeasance, which is a polite way of saying he's doing stuff that would put us mere mortals in jail for decades. And, of course, he's one of his best friends is a former president, and he can drop by the White House at any time. So he's definitely a Class A oligarch, I would suggest. And didn't the Lord Jesus go into the temple and chase out the money changers? Do you recall that?
Well, you know, in the Stop Shopping church, we are not Christians. We're in recovery from, well, we're an immigrant New York choir. We're in recovery from different gods from around the world.
Right, but the Reverend...
That's basic to our message. That's basic to our community. I think it's certainly important to stop worshiping big banks. I mean, they sort of have become the fundamentalist church of the United States, certainly, and England as well, Germany as well. I think some of the big Western countries. We had the sensation when we were in this Midtown wealthy Chase Bank performing the spirit of the extinct Golden Toad. We had an impression that we felt in touch with the Greensboro Four at the counter in the Woolworths. We felt in touch with Pussy Riot on the altar of dancing to their punk music in the altar of the Russian Orthodox Church. We felt, oh, we're finding a place where we can suddenly really talk to our fellow citizens.
Well, apparently,
by our symbolism, we this is a zeitgeist place we found here, because when we started singing our song, our Golden Toad song, we really felt like the thick consumer air around us was cracking, and some of the people who worked there were smiling and cell phoning us, you know, taking a movie. Others were really upset. Other people were giggling in the corner. One lady kind of ran away. I mean, we broke open that consumer world, and it's scary a little bit, but it's certainly something we have to do in our culture. We have to break out of consumerism.
Well, it seems, Reverend Billy, that the Manhattan Assistant District Attorney, Sarah Walsh, who asked for $30,000 bail for you and your other defendant, the head of your choir.
Nehemiah Luckett is the music director, yeah.
Yeah, and so she
a native of Jackson, Mississippi.
But she did not clearly get the joke. Did the judge get the joke? I mean, how have we so become such a paranoid police state since 9/11 that nobody can take a joke anymore?
Well, we're in an interesting time in New York City right now, as 3 out of 4 New Yorkers voted for a man in a mixed-race marriage named Bill de Blasio, who criticized from the very beginning Stop and Frisk, where 650,000 mostly young Hispanic and African-American men of color were just being stopped on the street with no explanation, forced up against the wall, patted down. And this was going on ever since 9/11. And in this 20 years of Giuliani and Bloomberg, there's a kind of exhaustion here in New York from the police brutality. So many young men of color and young women of color shot and killed with impunity here. It was just happening on a regular basis. We're hoping that the DA's office feels the imperative here that 3 out of 4, I mean, de Blasio was elected with 96% of the black vote. I mean, this is a major statement, and if democracy works at all, it's working right now. I mean, you know, I hope we're just being hopeful. We've been let down by Obama and others in the past, but right now, you can imagine, we're starting to breathe some fresh air here. Has it gotten into the claustrophobic confines of the DA's office? No, not yet.
Well, I hope that common sense prevails here, and I will definitely send you a jar of mustard to the tombs if that's where I have to address it.
Rikers Island.
Rikers Island.
All right. If I can just add my little plug here for our Stop Shopping Church, we're about to perform opening November 24th. November 24th, we're opening a series of our church services at the Public Theater in a place called Joe's Pub, about 100 feet from a Starbucks where I've been arrested about 24 times. And this is the subject of our performances.
Give out the website or the however people can get.
Thank you for asking. RevBilly.com. You can email me personally through the homepage. And joespub.com is how you find out information. Well, both those obvious websites have all the information you need. Mm-hmm. And we're putting up petitions on change.org. It should be showing up sometime tomorrow. We hope to get 10,000 petitions. We've been communicating with our fellow activists, and we're hoping for the best. Mm-hmm. It's scary. A year in prison is a scary thing. I have a 3-year-old daughter, and I love the singers, and we have a community here, and it is a shot across our bow. It's a statement from Chase, I think, as much as the city. I don't know.
Right.
It seems that way. The present commissioner, Ray Kelly, who has championed Stop and Frisk in New York City, has accepted a job at J.P. Morgan Chase.
Well, there we have a perfect ending there. I thank you so much for joining us, Reverend Billy.
Ursaluja, Brother Ian. Thank you.
Praise the Lord. Again, I've been speaking with Reverend Billy, who's an anti-corporatist activist who, in the role of a revivalist minister, leads the Stop Shopping Gospel Choir, a group of activists who defend neighborhood economies and freedom of expression in public places. They are known for their staging of mock religious revivals against consumerism, and their devils are Keystone, tar sands, mountaintop removal, fracking, and the banks that finance environmental plunder. He is currently facing a battery of misdemeanor charges, including rioting, and facing jail for a 15-minute musical protest he and his gospel choir staged at a Chase Bank in Midtown, New York City last month. They were wearing toad hats at the time. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.